welcome. Today is Wednesday, July 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, history is made at the Democratic Convention in the United States.
The first one who will be called Madam President, Hillary Rodham Clinton.
We're protected against physical attacks, but what about cyber threats? The Islamic State takes responsibility for yet another attack on France. Also ahead, an up-and-coming Australian musician topping the charts in the U.S. It's all on today's International Edition. Breaking a historic barrier, Hillary Clinton triumphantly captures the Democratic nomination for president Tuesday night. The first woman ever to lead a major political party into the general election. Delegates erupted in cheers as Clinton's primary rival, Bernie Sanders, helped make it official when the roll call got to his home state of Vermont, an important show of unity for a party trying to heal deep divisions.
Madam Chair, I move that the convention suspend the procedural rules. I move that all votes cast by delegates be reflected in the official record, and I move that Hillary Clinton be selected as the nominee of the Democratic Party for President of the United States.
That was a striking parallel to the role Clinton played 8 years ago when she stepped up to the microphone on the convention floor in Denver in support of her former rival, Barack Obama. Well, there were plenty of celebrities who spoke on behalf of Hillary and against Donald Trump, including Lena Dunham and America Ferrara.
Donald's not making America great again. He's making America hate again. And the vast majority of us, we cannot afford to see his vision of America come to be.
Luckily, we the voters carry the future of this country. We don't accept hatred as the norm in our communities. So why would we ever accept it in the Oval Office?
So to everyone here tonight and out there watching at home, here is your chance to join Team Hillary.
Well, in November, she'll take on Donald Trump, who was nominated last week at the Republican convention. Tuesday's speakers included mothers of the movement, the mothers of Trayvon Martin, Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Sandra Bland, and other young black victims of violence, with the evening culminating in a speech by former President Bill Clinton.
I have lived a long, full, blessed life. It really took off when I met and fell in love with that girl in the spring of 1971. When I was president, I worked hard to give you more peace and shared prosperity, to give you an America where nobody is invisible or counted out. But for this time, Hillary is uniquely qualified to seize the opportunities and reduce the risk we face. And she is still the best darn change maker I have ever known.
All right. Well, joining us now with a roundup of all the day's highlights, VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson, who is live at the convention in Philadelphia. Catherine, what a day.
That's right, Lori. I am right outside the arena right now, watching all of the delegates stream over to their buses after a long but very eventful day. And I tell you, even though they've been sitting in there for hours, they look energized. This was a very exciting day inside that convention.
What was your overall sense of today's events that stood out?
I think what we really saw in this day of the convention was what the Democrats wanted to see was the real Hillary Clinton. We heard that in her husband Bill Clinton's speech. He contrasted the Hillary Clinton shown by the Republican Party and the real Hillary Clinton that he knows. And he made this great point to the delegates that got the whole crowd roaring and cheering, you've nominated the real Hillary Clinton. So I think that's the big takeaway from the second day here at the convention.
And so you think that that he did his job, that he fulfilled his mission as to humanize her in some way that she hasn't been able to do herself?
Well, first of all, everything about tonight was playing to Bill Clinton's strengths. We all know that he loves giving a good speech. He loves telling these personal types of stories. And in this moment, he was being called upon to tell the personal stories about his own wife, to really humanize her and make her seem like a person that all of these delegates and out in the United States, these people can relate to her and will want to vote for her in November. And from the reaction in the crowd tonight, he more than fulfilled that job.
Lots of celebrities there as well, really, one by one coming up on the stage.
Oh, and not even on the stage. They're also in the crowd, too. You know, you see actresses and Broadway stars and singers. It really is a very well-produced event, and we have a lot of people coming out to support Hillary Clinton.
What about Bernie Sanders supporters? Have they calmed down today? Are they still as upset as they seemed in the beginning of all of this?
Well, you know, that was the one moment of disunity here today, is that after she was voted by acclamation by Bernie Sanders himself and named the nominee, there was a small group of protesters who walked out of the arena and across the street to the media center where we all sit, and they actually were camped out in the middle of the media center saying things like, Bernie or bust, no justice, no peace, you know, just seemed very upset that they had missed their chance, that this was finally nothing else could be done, that indeed Hillary Clinton was the nominee and that Bernie Sanders had, you know, moved on and given up on that chance of being the president of the United States.
Well, they overall really seemed to show a lot of unity. And I thought that the ending was quite interesting after Bill Clinton with a video of all those presidents we've had.
Absolutely. Again, this has been a very well-produced event that has some great entertainers. They really know how to build up the drama and emotion of a convention with that crowd inside the arena. And that moment was a really special one, to see Hillary Clinton, you know, appear on that screen for the first time. Everybody just went crazy for that.
Right, showing all those male presidents that we've had throughout the years. And then
there's Hillary Clinton.
So it should be an interesting week ahead. Any idea who we can expect to see tomorrow on stage?
So another big night tomorrow. We have Vice President Joe Biden and, of course, the president himself, Barack Obama, speaking tomorrow night. So it'll be another long, exciting evening here in Philadelphia.
Well, we know you will be keeping us updated on all of it, and we thank you so much
That's great. Your time.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson, live at the convention in Philadelphia. Thanks so much. Well, let's take a look now at what's been trending online regarding the Democratic National Convention. And for that, we turn to our social media guru, G. Abby Lee. Hi, G.
Hi, Lori. The popular hashtags differ on Facebook and Twitter. Hashtag DNC is the most widely used hashtag on Facebook, but on Twitter, hashtag Dems in Philly and hashtag Dem Convention are both being used. Many of Sanders supporters are still voicing support for the Vermont senator using hashtags like Bernie or bust, but he had already asked his delegates to support Clinton.
Gee, apart from Senator Sanders, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, and First Lady Michelle Obama all receiving positive responses for their speech last night, at least from the media. What's the online reaction like to that?
Well, GOP nominee Donald Trump has been tweeting about the Democratic event, and his tweet about Senator Booker is getting quite a bit of attention on social media. Trump tweeted, "If Cory Booker is the future of the Democratic Party, they have no future. I know more about Cory than he knows about himself." Now, during an interview with CNN Tuesday, Cory was asked what he thinks about the tweet, and he answered, "I love you, Donald. I pray for you. I hope you find some kindness in your heart." And many of his supporters found that to be a classy response.
I'll say.
What do you think?
I'll say. What else are people talking about in terms of the convention?
A celebrity campaign against Donald Trump is trending on Twitter, and it's called hashtag United Against Hate. Well-known celebrities like Julianne Moore and Kerry Washington joined the movement on the MoveOn.org website. Many liberal celebrities view Trump as inciting hate, which his supporters strongly disagree with. Lori, back to you.
All right. Thanks so much, as always, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. U.S. Muslims are urged to engage in the political process. Hot, dry weather hampers firefighters battling California wildfires. Pyongyang says the U.S. would pay a terrifying price for destabilizing the Korean Peninsula. Food industry opportunities abound for young people. And Dutch entrepreneurs are turning rainwater into beer. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. International Edition continues. Well, with the first female nominee for president for a major party in the United States of America, it does have some historical significance. We're joined now by Jennifer Lawless, director of the Women in Politics Institute at American University in Washington, D.C. Jennifer, thanks for being here. How significant is this moment in U.S. history?
I think that it's important to recognize that this is the kind of moment, the significance can't be overstated. It's not only the first time that a woman has received a major party's nomination for president, but it's also a woman with unprecedented credentials and qualifications. So this is, an incredibly serious candidate who's very well positioned to win the White House.
Michelle Obama really made that point quite clear. I mean, the highest, hardest glass ceiling is shattered now. Those words everyone remembers from the last time Hillary Clinton ran against Barack Obama, and the significance of how far she'd come then and now to see this come to fruition. I'm sure there are a lot of women out there and young girls especially that are looking at this with maybe a different perspective.
I think that's right. I mean, I would say two things. The first is that the highest, hardest glass ceiling has been shattered, but she still has the race to win. Right. So this is a milestone in that she's garnered the nomination, but there is still one more step, and that will represent the actual final breaking through the glass ceiling. But it's true that for a generation of young women and for girls, the presidential candidates that they'll know and they'll think of when they think of their youth will be an African-American man, a woman, and that represents something that previous generations haven't had access to. And, well, you know, that in and of itself is very important.
They've seen the pictures on the walls in different government buildings, maybe, when they went on school field trips of all the presidents of the United States, and they were all white men.
Right. And now there's a chance that, and now we know that young people today see an African-American man, but there's a very good chance that they're also going to see a woman. And that opens up possibilities that seemed like far more of a stretch for people who are my age or who are my mother's age.
Why do you think it is that so many other countries are ahead of the U.S. when it comes to having a female leader?
Well, in some countries, the female leader is more symbolic than substantive in role. But a lot of the other nations that have had female leaders have had female candidates. And that was the title of my first book, It Takes a Candidate. This is really the first time, 2008 marked the first time, but Hillary Clinton is the first candidate that has been a woman with a real shot at winning. And in part, it's because when you've got a debate stage with 12 or 16 or 17 people and there's only one woman, any one candidate's chances are pretty low. So Carol Moseley Braun ran in 2004, and Michelle Bachmann ran in 2012, and Carly Fiorina ran in 2016, but they shared the stage with a dozen other candidates, most of whom also lost. Until women represent a greater proportion of female presidential candidates, they're going to not represent a great proportion of
female
presidents.
How big of a deal will it be if Hillary Clinton actually wins the presidency?
I think it'll be a huge deal, to use the language of some other candidates. It would be huge. and I think it'll be a big deal for several reasons. The first is obviously symbolically, you know, having a woman in the White House is something that we've never before had, and a lot of other nations have already had female heads of state. So it allows us to sort of fall into that category. It'll be a big deal because the issues that Hillary Clinton has championed have traditionally been issues that disproportionately affect women, families, and children. So it's not just having a woman in the White House. It's having a woman in the White House who really cares about women's experiences. and women's place in society. And I think it'll also be a really big deal because she ran a very heated, good race in 2008, lost, and then came back to give it another shot. And I think that perseverance and that kind of grit is admirable, and it'll be an example for other women that sometimes you don't make it on your first try, but that doesn't mean that you hang up your hat and quit.
Thank you so much. Jennifer Lawless, director of the Women in Politics Institute at American University. Well, the Islamic State group crossed a new threshold Tuesday in its war against the West as two of its followers targeted a church in Normandy, slitting the throat of an 85-year-old priest celebrating Mass and using hostages as human shields before being shot by police. One of the assailants was identified as Adel Karmiche, a 19-year-old who grew up in the town and tried to travel to Syria twice last year, but was arrested outside France and handed preliminary terrorism charges. Ben Haddad is with the Hudson Institute.
It's an extremely gruesome attack on an 86-year-old man in the countryside, a man of the church, a priest, so it's a very shocking attack. But it's also very shocking because, once again, you could see shortcoming when it comes to security response to this threat. This was, as is often the case, a person who was already known of the authorities. He had tried two times to go to Syria through Turkey, had been arrested at the borders. The second time, he had actually been arrested and tried in France. So he had been incarcerated for 10 months and then was afterwards put in house arrest with an electronic tag that supposedly was supposed to be able to track his movement and prevent him from fleeing or carrying such an attack. So once again, you see shortcomings, especially when it comes to the judicial system, not so much intelligence or security, but the legal and judicial system in preventing these attacks.
A nun who escaped described seeing the attackers film themselves and give a sermon in Arabic around the altar before she fled. Tuesday's attack occurred days after a man drove over hundreds of Bastille Day revelers in the French Riviera city of Nice, killing 84 people. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The U.S. presidential election takes place on November 8, 2016. VOA provides extensive coverage of this important political event. Who are the candidates, and what are the issues that will determine who the next president will be? Tune in around the clock for coverage of the U.S. presidential election, right here on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. On the heels of a major hack of the Democratic National Committee emails and with concerns about threats of sophisticated hacking adversaries, the Obama administration Tuesday issued new instructions on how government agencies should respond to major cybersecurity attacks. Joining me now to talk more about this, Jameel Jaffer, adjunct professor and director of the Homeland and National Security Law Program at the George Mason University School of Law. Jameel, how vulnerable are we, and do we have enough protocol in place?
Today, we expect the private sector to defend itself against all threat actors, but in no other context do we expect that of the private sector. You know, we don't expect Target to have surface air missiles on its roof, you know, to protect against Russian bombers, and yet we expect, you know, Target to protect itself against Russian hackers, the DNC to protect itself against Russian hackers. You know, we don't have a plan for how to do that. And you look at the current, you know, the new response plan that came out today, and it talks about FBI and DHS, of course, which is important, but it doesn't fundamentally address the issue of what happens when it's a committed, high-powered adversary like a nation state coming at me. What am I supposed to do? And if I'm attacked, am I going to be held liable for that? Am I going to pay the price? Debbie Wasserman Schultz paid a price, right? Do we expect private sector CEOs to pay a price like that? I mean, we get to have that whole conversation. So,
amid the suspicion in the U.S. government that hackers working for Russia may have engineered the leak of DNC emails. The White House has now issued new instructions on how government agencies should respond to major cybersecurity attacks. Would you say they're attempting to combat perception that they haven't really addressed the threats of sophisticated hackers?
Yeah, I think today's announcement of the response plan has long been in the works. They've been working on this for quite a while. It's primarily aimed at how the government interacts with the private sector, right? And who's got the lead for investigation? Who's got the lead for remediation? How does the intel community play in? A notable gap here, obviously, is the lack of any attention to the role of DOD and the State Department in responding to an incident. Of course, those will be very important if, in fact, it's determined that the attack was a nation-state attack, and even if it was against the private sector, because, you know, depending on the nature and scale and scope of an attack, whether against the private or public sectors, if it comes from a nation-state, surely you're going to expect DOD and the State Department to be involved, and it's surprising that that's not addressed here. But I'm not sure it's a response to what we're seeing, you know, in terms of the DNC effort. I think it's a longer-term effort that's been ongoing. The government does have a real challenge here. I mean, the government has faced a number of hacks on its own systems, including against the unclassified systems of the White House, the State Department, OPM, obviously, to just name a few, many of which are believed to have come either by nation states or at the behest of nation states through proxy groups working on behalf of the nation states. It's a very real threat targeting both the government and the private sector. In fact, one of the things that a lot of people haven't talked about as directly as you might have hoped is, you know, what we've seen is a real trend change in attacks against the U.S. private sector. One thing we've talked a lot about is this sort of theft of intellectual property, principally by China. But a new and a disturbing trend is the use of destructive attacks against private sector companies. We first saw it in 2012 with the attacks against Saudi Aramco and Qatari RasGas. But we've now seen it in the United States, attributed directly by the U.S. government to nation-state actors. In the case of the Las Vegas Sands Corporation, attributed to Iran. And in the case of Sony Corporation, attributed to North Korea. And both of those actually involved actual destruction of data and sort of damaging of actual, you know, systems. And so that's a really troubling trend, particularly when you note that it's being undertaken by countries that might be less susceptible to normal convincing or deterrence, like Russia and China might be more likely to be deterred.
How big of a risk do you think we face right now when it comes to issues of cybersecurity?
Look, I mean, I think the trend is not good. The trend is there's an increased threat today because in a number of ways, you've got nation-state actors that are very capable, Russia and China being primary amongst them. Then you've got smaller nation-state actors that are becoming increasingly more capable and showing a willingness to use destructive capabilities, Iran, North Korea, in that category. And then you've got these criminal groups that are, you know, very active in recognizing that cyber is a way to make money quickly and with fairly low friction. And so you've got organized criminal groups, organized crime getting into this. And then perhaps the most troubling, but with the least capability, at least today, are terrorist groups who are looking for asymmetric tools like cyber, where they can have an outsized impact for their capability. But luckily, they don't have yet the capability, but they're certainly determined to get it. So across the spectrum of threat actors, we're seeing an increased threat to the United States and to our allies, and that's a real problem. And that doesn't even account for the massive, massive, hugely economically damaging theft of U.S. intellectual property that's at the core of our economic engine by nation states like China, who use it for economic advantage.
All right. Well, we appreciate your insights. Jamil Jaffer, Director of the Homeland Security and National Security Law Program at George Mason University. Turning to entertainment news, singer Sia has a new hit single that's taken the number one chart on the charts. International Edition, Sarah Williams talks about it with VOA's Border Crossings host, Larry London.
Now, if you don't know Sia, she's from Australia and has been doing this a long time, has been writing songs. She's written number one songs for, like, for example, Diamonds, which Rihanna sang and became a number one song. She's written some others as well, Titanium, which was a number one song. And so she's been in the game for a while. But as far as albums go, the last couple of albums have done well for her. The previous album was called 1,000 Forms of Fear. She had a hit called Chandelier. And now the new song is called Cheap Thrills, and it's her first number one, but it's with Sean Paul, who's from Jamaica, and this is his fourth number one song. So let's listen to it.
Up with it, girl. Rock with it, girl. Show them it, girl. Bada bang bang. Bounce with it, girl. Dance with it, girl. Get with it, girl. Bada bang bang.
Come on, come on. Turn the radio on. Got my makeup on. It's Friday night and
Well, that sounds like it was a pretty good partnership between those two.
It is, Sia and Sean Paul. And it's been a while for Sean Paul. It's been 10 years since he's been at number one. The last time it was a song called Get Busy. But Sia's new album is called This Is Acting. And she said she called the album that because most people have to put on a fake persona when they're out in public. They, you know, smile when you don't feel like smiling, be happy. So she said, we're kind of acting all the time. So this is her little metaphor approach at the way life goes for a lot of people. Sia herself is a very interesting and unique individual. She always has a wig covering her face. She doesn't like fame.
Huh.
So this is an interesting career choice.
Absolutely.
For someone who prefers not to be famous. So she's famous, and the wig kind of brings extra attention to her, and she's on tour right now, and she performs with the wig. Very interesting. She doesn't dance. She stands on stage, stands in one place the entire concert, and sings. And she has a 13-year-old dancer who joins her on tour. Her name is Maddie Ziegler, and she's become famous for reality TV here in the United States. But it's kind of an interesting show to see. She performed at Coachella Valley Festival. She did a 45-minute set. By far, a lot of the critics said that was the best performance of the entire festival. So she puts on a great show. Sia's had a difficult life. She was addicted to painkillers for a while, struggled with depression. But she's a tremendously talented person and a great songwriter.
And this way, by wearing a wig on her face, when she goes out in public, she's not mobbed by fans.
That's right. People still wonder, could that be Sia? Sia Furler is her real name. She's tremendously talented. And I don't think this is going to be her last number one song.
So glad you could join us for this edition of International Edition. You can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran has reported that Giti Purfasel, a human rights lawyer who defended political prisoners and their families in Iran for a decade, has submitted her resignation to Iran's Bar Association and given up her law practice. Ms. Purfasel told the campaign she did so because of the constant harassment she received from Iranian authorities. Among Ms. Purfasel's clients were imprisoned Shiite cleric Ayatollah Hossein Kazemini Borujerdi, an advocate for the separation of religion from politics, the family of blogger Sattar Beheshti, who was beaten to death in police custody, and Kurdish-Iranian human rights defender Mohammad Sadiq Kaboudvand. Referring to the persistent threats and pressure she received from Iran's intelligence ministry, Ms. Purfasel said, "In this society, lawyers who bear witness to injustice and speak the truth get punished." The State Department's most recent report on human rights in Iran adds credence to her statement. The report notes, for example, the periodic jailing of political activist and lawyer Nasrin Sotoudeh, the imprisonment of lawyers and others affiliated with the Defender of Human Rights Center advocacy group, such as Abdul Fattah Soltani, who was serving a 13-year sentence for the alleged crime of colluding and conspiring against national security, and the 9-year prison term being served by center founder and human rights attorney Mohammad Ali Dadkha, purportedly for plotting a soft revolution and propaganda against the system. Those who defend the legal rights of others help safeguard the rule of law and make up a critical component of a nation's civil society. And, as President Barack Obama has emphasized, a healthy civil society is essential to a nation's success.
Civil society is the conscience of our countries. It's the catalyst of change. It's why strong nations don't fear active citizens.
The United States urges Iran, as it does all countries, to stop the harassment of lawyers and human rights defenders, release those who are currently in detention for their work, and recognize their crucial role in a healthy and just society.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
for, what's your